let's go. Today, we have a class that we're going to talk about a common concept in Judaism, at least in the Hasidic world, it's a common idea. And we're going to see a perspective based on the teachings of the Rebbe. Bear with me, some part you will not like, I know that. And then you'll see, at the end, I think you'll like it. But whatever. Things have to be intellectually honest, intellectually correct. Whether they're nice or not, it doesn't really matter. Okay, let's go. First of all, the subject, I didn't mention this, the subject is down here, mind over heart. It is a common concept in Judaism that the mind has to somehow control. Just a second, I'll change myself over there. Yeah, it's going to be better for the presentation. Okay, so the mind has to control whatever happens in the heart. Usually we identify the mind with intellect, with thought, etc., and the heart with emotions. This doesn't mean, even though this is not the main subject of our class today, but this doesn't mean that a person becomes like the mind, the cold thing, calculator, and no feelings. And no, not at all. Don't get mixed up. Don't make this mistake. It doesn't mean that. It means that the emotions, in order to be proper emotions, they need a guidance. When they don't have guidance, they become like crazy things, really, really nuts and crazy. Some details of this we'll see later. It's not the main subject of the class. So the point over here is not to annul and destroy emotions, become like a cold ice cube. No. The point over here is to guide the emotions, to give them room in the proper direction. In order to understand this, first we have to understand a few ideas, which just on this slide I could spend a whole year, and I'm not going to do that, of course, and I'm not going to spend the whole time on this. My objective is to reach something else. However, it's important to know at least the most fundamental ideas, why the concept of intellect and emotions come up. How does this come from a God that doesn't have any definitions? Even though it says, as I wrote over there, the man was created in the image of God, Betzelem Elohim Bares Adam, God made us in his tselem, image, way, whatever you want to say, doesn't really matter. However, we know that God doesn't have any image. God doesn't have any tselem, any form or any type of form of body or whatever. So what does it mean that we were created in his image? One idea, there are others, one idea is that there has to be some kind of system in which we can, so to speak, coexist. We can live with an infinite God, no definition, no understanding of him, nothing you can say about him, etc. And on the other hand, our perspective of things, that we have a soul, we have a body, we have arms, and we have eyes, and we have all kinds of things that, of course, we do have. And that's an image of God that was created in the image of God. In other words, in the Torah, and actually the Rambam talks about this, and many, many philosophers, Jewish philosophers talk about this, how come in the Torah it says God is sitting, God is a warrior, God took us from Egypt with an extended arm. What do you mean, arm? God sees us with his eyes, the eyes of God go around the earth. What do you mean? He doesn't have eyes. So again, I'm just touching the surface, so to speak, of the mystical explanation of these ideas. The simple explanation of these ideas is actually very simple, because you can say we talk about God the way we understand. It's impossible to understand him. There's nothing you can say about him. So we say, we explain him in the way we understand, just as a person takes his extended arm and picks up something. So God took us from Egypt with his extended arm. Whatever that means, doesn't matter. It's anthropomorphical ideas. Okay, very nice. That's the simple explanation. Mystical explanation is one step above, so to speak. A little bit more. What does that mean, a little bit more? God is infinite. There's nothing you can say about him and nothing you cannot say about him. So that leaves us empty-handed. How do we deal with this? This world is a finite world. We can define it. I am myself, you are yourself, and so on. How do you pass from that stage of infinity to our stage of definitions, etc., etc.? This concept is called in Kabbalah, in Hasidus, in mystical thought, Tzimtzum. I wrote it over there, which the simple, easiest translation would be concealment. God conceals himself and shows himself to us in a specific way, through a specific definition that we can somehow, because he wanted so, deal with. And therefore we say that God has wisdom, God has kindness, God has mercy, and anything you want to say about him, it's true. He, so to speak, expresses himself in those ways. Does it mean that he is composed of those ways? The answer is no. It's a big no. There's no composition of God. Forget it. Nothing you can say about him. He shows himself in these particular ways in order for us to be able to deal at some point with understanding him, with praising him, with talking to him, whatever you want to say, it doesn't really matter. It's just what he chose to show himself to us. This process, which I will not explain in detail right now, is not the point of the class. You will see why. This process is called Tzimtzum. Do we need to understand this process? Oh, yes. But not now. That's what the process is called. The interesting part of it that we are going to explain in this class is that this process of Tzimtzum generates, so to speak, different expressions of God that usually are called in the Hasidic writings and Kabbalah also Sefirot. Sefirot literally comes from the word Sefirah, which means bright, something bright, like a precious stone, which is bright, that expresses a specific aspect of something. Suppose, again, we have a precious stone. So if you have, I don't know the names in English, so I'm sorry, emerald, so it's going to be like green. If you have this ruby or whatever it's called, it's going to be like red. Okay, whatever. The thing is, it expresses a light, some kind of brightness. Okay, so he chose 10 specific that we will see in a minute without any details, but 10 specific expressions of himself. Why these 10? Why 10? The questions are good. Good questions, and they are actually asked in Hasidic works. And the point is, there could have been infinite expressions of God, infinite spheres, which would leave us empty-handed just as before. Because, okay, before this Tzimtzum, this contraction through which God expresses himself in these particular ways, we still have infinite expressions of God. So that means like it's the same as nothing. We can't deal with that. We can't deal with infinite. So he chose 10. Why 10? I don't know. These 10 specific things that we will see in a minute. And the interesting part of it is that, again, God expresses himself in this particular way. The whole creation is structured with this particular way that he chose to express himself. And that's the way he created man. Each one of us, Jews, non-Jews, it's the same thing. He created us with this structure. Why? Because our purpose as human beings is to bring the presence of God in this earth in order for it to be revealed. This is what he wanted. This is what the Midrash says. Dira betachtoinim, he wanted a dwelling place in this earth, etc. In order for us to take the creation and reveal his presence in this creation, so we need to be able to deal with the creation in a way that we can actually transform the creation from concealment of God, because you open your eyes and you don't see God, into something that reveals God. In order to accomplish that, God made something very, so to speak, easy and simple. He created everything with the same structure. So this is like a puzzle, you know? When you have two pieces of a puzzle that actually fit one to each other, so it becomes a nice drawing or whatever the piece of the puzzle that it is. But when they don't fit, because actually these two pieces don't fit, pick another one. When they don't fit, the picture that comes out of pushing, you know, pressing these two pieces doesn't really make sense. it doesn't look nice because these two pieces are not supposed to be together. They don't fit. So imagine every single piece fitting into each other, it becomes a nice drawing. So God is giving us a mission. The mission is to build this drawing. And he gave us the tools in order to fit each piece in its proper place. But for that, we have to understand each piece, and we have to be able to deal with each piece in its particular place. That's what it means, that God created everything with the same structure. What is this structure? Actually, I didn't mention it, but whatever. The tabernacle also, the mystics explain, Hasidus explain, Kabbalah explains, each part of the vessels of the tabernacle, the temple, also resembled, alluded to one particular piece of this huge puzzle, so to speak. And it also alludes to each piece of our own body, of our own soul. Everything was created with the same structure in order for everything to be able to fit and work one with each other. Okay, what's the structure? Very briefly, I will not explain each one of these details. It would take too long and we will miss the point of the class. I put the names over there. I know each one of these need explanation. I know that. But I want us to focus just on one thing. The titles. Not so much the undertitles or whatever they're called. The titles. Intellect, emotions, and garments. What does that mean? Of course, you can read it. That's why I put it over there. Intellect is formed with three different qualities, capacities, or whatever, and emotions is seven capacities, and garments is three. Okay, very nice. I'm just going to focus on the titles. The soul of a person is built with a structure that, I'm going back on purpose, I'll be back in a second, because the creation has the same structure, and God decided to express himself in the same structure. Let's go back, structure of the soul. The soul is built with such a structure that resembles creation, God, godly expressions, etc., etc., in order for us to be able to deal with the world and reveal the presence of God in the world. Okay, very nice. For that, the structure has basically two main parts. It's three, but two main parts, intellect and emotions. Intellect is just like whatever, the definition of dictionary. Mind and thoughts and whatever, the ideas a person has, etc. And emotions are any kind of emotion that a person could feel. Even though Kabbalah, Hasidus talk about seven specific things, but if you start combining all these seven, and not just seven times seven, which is 49, like you could combine these in infinite ways. Like seven times seven times seven times seven, there's no end to it, because you could put a small part of each one of these and suddenly becomes something else. It's just like combining colors. When you take colors and suppose you take seven colors, and then you start combining the seven colors, and different percentages of each color is going to create a different color, even if it's not so distinguishable to our eyes, but it doesn't matter. It's a different color. Technically speaking, it's a different color. So it's just these seven things. Again, why did God create these particular 10 expressions, seven emotional and three intellect? Go ask him. I don't know. Nobody knows, as far as I know. But the point is that he decided to create the world in this particular structure and our soul in this structure. And first of all comes intellect and then emotions. If you actually look at the body of a human being, you see the head is up above everything, and then the heart, which is the room, so to speak, for emotions, is below the head. That's for a reason. There's not just everything is the same. If you look at a regular animal, dog, cat, whatever, everything is the same level. Intellect and emotions are basically in the same level. He walks this way. We walk standing, and intellect is above, and emotions is below. Besides the different levels of each one of things, what's Chochmah, what's Bina, I don't care right now. I'm not going to explain. We have three garments. These garments express those emotions, express the wisdom of a person. Imagine a person is very smart, but he doesn't talk. So very nice, but nobody knows how smart you are. You have to talk, you have to say something, and then people are going to say, oh, yeah, really? 1 plus 1 is 2. Hey, this guy is smart. He knows how to add 1 plus 1. That's good. But if he doesn't say anything, there's no way to evaluate whether this person knows or not. That's dibur, that's speech. Same thing happens with action. Action means the person actually changing the world around himself. And machshava, thought, of course, goes within your head, and that also shapes the way you are. The way you think is the way you're going to be shaped, and the way you are shaped is the way you're going to think. It works both ways, back and forth, back and forth. But these are garments of the soul. This is not part of you. How do you know that? Because one of the qualities of a garment is that you can change it any way you want, anytime you want. I'm dressed with this, I can take it out and put something else. That's easy, so to speak. But the way I feel is not so easy to change, so to speak. Suddenly, hey, be happy. I'm not happy today. Okay? Something happened. Yeah, but you have to smile. Today is not coming out. I'm so sorry. Maybe tomorrow, but today, I don't feel so. That's why it's not the same. That's why, you have garments, and then you have the qualities of the person. Even having said that, this intellect and emotions are just powers of the soul. It's not the soul itself. The soul is something else. There are different levels, different names and ideas that we're not going to touch on them, but at least to be able to know, to be aware, that intellect and emotions, even though today this is our subject and the interaction between them, however, is not the essence of the soul. It's not what really defines us. Now, how do we know that these garments are so important and they express us, etc.? There are different places in the Talmud and around stories in Hasidus that shows us that these expressions of ourselves, our souls, garments, thoughts, speech, and action, are really important. First of all, I just copied it to two places because I think they are like very clear. There's a pact, there's a bris, a covenant done with the lips, that whatever the lips produce and say, be careful. It might happen. It might happen. So a person has to be very careful. The Talmud says this. A person has to be very careful what you say, actually. And even a tzaddik, even a righteous person, the Talmud says when he makes a statement, even if it was a conditional statement, still has an expression in the world. Still, quote unquote, happens. So a person has to be really, really careful what you say. And another very famous place in the Talmud, never open your mouth to the accuser, so to speak. Some call it the Satan, some Achmem, whatever you want to call it, I don't care, the other side, it doesn't really matter. Don't open your mouth to it. Like saying, this person should be punished. Really? Don't talk. Or when a person is given an example, suppose I'm sick. No, don't say that. Suppose somebody is sick. Whatever. I'm giving you an example of somebody sick. Don't talk about yourself. Suppose my son gets hit by a car. No. Don't say that. Don't open your mouth to judgment. Say somebody is hit by a car, whatever. So these are two places in the Talmud, very clear and easy to understand, but things that happen in the future, not necessarily now. There's a story about the Baal Shem Tov over here, we're in the middle, so to speak, of the slide. The story goes like this. In the synagogue of the Baal Shem Tov, he was the founder of Hasidism, and at the end of 1600s, beginning of 1700s, and he was in a synagogue in Mezhibuzh. Mezhibuzh is a very small place in Ukraine. And two people were arguing, actually, over something, I don't know what. And they were screaming this and that, this and that. And one said to the other one, I'll cut you like a fish. You know, when you open a fish and you take all the garbage out of the fish to eat, I'll cut you like a fish. So the Baal Shem Tov, when they were arguing, told his students to hold the hands. Everybody made like a circle with the hands. And he actually held the hands of the two students that were by him. Everybody, close your eyes. They closed their eyes. And they saw this guy cutting his fellow like a sheep. Like a fish, I'm sorry. Like a fish. Really, like, rah, everything was coming out. And the students were so scared that they just left the hands. And suddenly they saw again two guys arguing. Nobody touched anybody. Nobody was dead over there with everything out. No, no, no. So the Baal Shem Tov explained to his students that from anything you say, not only has an effect in the future, like, okay, don't open your lips because something might happen, you know. No, no, no. Right now, this is happening. Whatever you're saying, it's happening right now. Maybe you don't see it with your eyes in a physical way because these two guys were arguing and the truth is that they didn't touch each other. But in a spiritual realm, definitely this is happening. Definitely. So you have to be very, very careful to what you say, with what you say. And furthermore, not only what you say, there's a story. I put the source over there. I know this source, you cannot reach it so easily. So I'll tell you very briefly what the story is. It's a long story, but I'll make it very short. The Likutei Diburim, which is the source that I'm taking this out from, it's a book of talks by the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson of blessed memory. And he starts this book, it's a long book, long book, very interesting, with these words, Machshava Moyeles. I put it in English over there, thought helps. Machshava Moyeles, thought helps. And the story basically is, you know, the communist Russia many years ago, the previous Rebbe passed away in 1950. So you can imagine before that even, communist Russia was very, very hard with the Jews, very hard, with religious Jews in particular. And with Chabad in particular, like the word Schneerson, which is the last name of the Rebbe, was a bad word. Nobody wanted to receive a letter from a Schneerson because you were out. Forget it. Okay, so when the Hasidim used to send letters to the Rebbe and the Rebbe sent back letters, it was the Zayde, the grandfather. That's what the Rebbe was, the grandfather. I'm writing to my grandfather, don't bother me. No names over there. Never Schneerson, never Menachem Mendel, never nothing, just the grandfather. Okay, so in communist Russia, there was a guy, I forgot the name right now, but whatever, he was having difficulties because the previous Rebbe, he himself held a whole underground network of schools, of teachers for Judaism, you know, authentic Judaism. And the Russians were very, very much against this. They actually put in prison the previous Rebbe. It's a whole story, long story, that's why I'm saying. It's really long, but there was one Hasid living in one particular place that he held a school, very small school. And he was really having problems. He was chased and he was spied and it was very, very difficult. Most of them were sent to Siberia, you know. Okay, so at some point he was by the Rebbe, by the previous Rebbe, and they were having, in Yiddish it's called a farbrengen, they were spending time together, talking and sharing words of Torah, etc., etc. And this Chosid asked the Rebbe whether the Rebbe at any point makes a time to think about the Hasidim. Like, do you really think about us? We think about you, Rebbe, all the time, but do you think about us? And the Rebbe asked just one question. Where were you in last Sukkot? Sukkot is it's a holiday by the Jews, whatever. Where were you? Do you remember? And the Chosid, when he heard the answer of the Rebbe, he understood clearly. The Rebbe thinks about the Hasidim. He particularly, this Chosid, had a very tough problem, that Sukkot. The Russians were really on top of him. He was like very short from being caught and sent to Siberia, etc., etc. And there was no possibility of writing to the Rebbe, of calling the Rebbe, whatever, forget it, no phones, no nothing. He was just thinking about the Rebbe. And the Rebbe answered, I was thinking about you. Where were you in Sukkot, last Sukkot? I was thinking about you. That's why you didn't get caught, you know, the whole thing. Whatever, I was thinking about you. So don't ask me if the Rebbe thinks about the Hasidim. Of course, of course. So that we see from there that thought also helps. If we think bad thoughts about somebody, we're actually creating in that somebody bad feelings. And if we think in a positive way, of course, how much more so in a positive way about somebody, we're creating good feelings in that somebody for whatever we're thinking. So we see that the garments really express the emotions, the thoughts. It's really what makes an effect in this world. With all of this information, I'm going back on purpose. There's a structure that all the creation in human beings and souls and everything is in this structure, even the temple, etc. And this structure is basically composed of intellect, emotions, and garments. And the garments express and have an effect in the world, express the soul and have an effect in the world. Let's go to mind and heart. With this information, we will be able to understand how they interact. And it doesn't finish over here. You will see. I hope you will like it. At the beginning, you will not like it. But then you'll like it. So be patient. This is a very small piece of the Rambam. The Rambam talking about loving God and fearing God. I'm going on purpose to the end first of this slide down here, B'nai Noyach. Everybody agrees, there's no obligation, and I stress the word obligation on B'nai Noyach to love God. For Jews, it is a mitzvah. It's an obligation. Whatever that means, we'll see in a minute in the above part. There's no obligation to love God. That doesn't mean that it's forbidden. No, we're just saying it's not obligation. You can love God anything you want. It's fine. You're not obligated to that. Point number one. Point number two, fear of God. It is an obligation on B'nai Noach also. On the Jews also, of course. But it is an obligation definitely on B'nai Noach also. Having said all of that, let's go back to the beginning. I'll read this part because it's very interesting. This is the Rambam answering, basically, a very simple question. Very simple question. The question is, there is a mitzvah, it's a commandment, a positive commandment, like an order. Very simple translation of commandment, mitzvah, order. I obligate you, says God, I obligate you to love me. Again, we explained that for B'nai Noach it doesn't apply, whatever. I'm obligating you to fear me. The simple question that Rambam asks is, you can't obligate a person on emotions. You could obligate on actions. I put a gun on your head. You do whatever what I say or I kill you, okay? I'm obligating you. Or you get killed, whatever. But you can't obligate me to love you. Like put again a gun on my head and say, love me. So, I'm sorry, I don't love you. It doesn't work. No way. And now that you put a gun in my head, of course I don't love you. I fear you, but I don't love you. No way. So what does it mean, a mitzvah, an obligation to love? And the Rambam answers with these words. I actually copied from the English translation. What is the path to attain love and fear of him, of God? How do you do that? When a person contemplates, the stress is mine, it's not the Rambam's, but when the person contemplates, thinks, meditates his wondrous and great deeds, God's and creation, and appreciates his infinite wisdom that surpasses all comparison, he will immediately love, praise, and glorify him. What is that I'm saying? Very simple. You only appreciate that which you take the time to think about. That's why I put a verse that has nothing to do with the Rambam. I'm just putting it over there. According to the intellect, a man is praise a man. That's what the verse says. So according to whatever you think, that's your praise, actually. Children, and there's nothing wrong about it, but children want and like small things, candies, and they get crazy. You didn't give me a candy. You know what? It's just a candy. Don't bother me. Yeah, that's because you're an adult. And you think like that, one more candy, one less candy. Nothing is going to change. But for the child, that's life. Candy, what do you mean? There's nothing else. Maybe we start saying money, okay, money makes more sense. But whatever, according to your intellect, that's where you're standing. That's where you praise. Again, we see here from the Rambam, and we'll read the second paragraph in a second. We see from the Rambam that according to your thoughts, you will develop and reveal in your heart emotions. The more you contemplate on the, using the words of the Rambam, great deeds, creations, infinite wisdom of God, you will start loving God. When he continues to reflect, says the Rambam, reflect means to think, to meditate, etc., etc., on the same matters, the greatness of God, the greatness of creation, etc., he will immediately recall in awe and fear. Ooh, this is really powerful. This is really... appreciating how he is a tiny man, is a tiny, lowly, dark creature standing with his flimsy, limited wisdom before he, who is of perfect knowledge, etc. You can continue reading the rest. So we see clearly that mind shapes the heart. And mind guides the heart to, so to speak, awaken to a certain reality. What do I mean by this? I mean like this. Everybody, a normal person, I'm not talking about people with problems, with mind problems, I'm not talking about that. Then go see a doctor and God should help you. But a normal person loves things. Each person loves something else. This one loves food, this one loves woman, this one loves man, this one loves alcohol, whatever. Every person has his own problems, quote unquote. That's normal. That's okay. The question is, what do you love? Or what do you fear? Which is actually the same thing basically. This is what the Rambam is saying also. It's the same thing, just which way you look at it. The point of service to God is to learn to love Him. What does that mean? It means spend time thinking about Him. Spend time thinking about creation. There's a very interesting book. It's not so short. I was making like a short sign because this part of the book is short. It's called Choyves Alevavos, the duties of the heart. He has over there portals, and the portal of Bechina, of reflection. Think about the creation around you, and you will start appreciating the wisdom of God, the greatness of God. This is exactly what the Rambam is saying. Think about how many birds are there, how many feathers each bird has, how many different sounds each bird produces, how many stones of different colors, and how many trees of different fruits. And start thinking about, and we will see the greatness of God. The more you think about it, the more details you're able to produce in your mind and to know, etc., etc., the greater God is going to be. Because you can say, yeah, God creates plants, vegetables, yeah, next. What do you mean? Wait a second. There are apples, there are bananas, there are, okay, all kinds of things and fruits. Think about them. The more detail, again, you think, the greater the sensation and the emotion of love is going to be. The greater the awareness of the greatness of God is going to be. And that's going to create sensations, again, and feelings in your heart. Okay, now we see clearly that the mind shapes, so to speak, the feelings, not necessarily creating the feelings. This is a deep thing that I'm not going to explain the whole thing now, but at least guiding the feelings. Don't feel so strong about food, start feeling strong about God. You will need food anyway, because otherwise you pass away. We need to eat, drink, etc., etc., sleep, whatever. But stop loving that and apply your quality, your capacity of love to God, towards God. Okay. Having said all of this, here comes the part that is not so nice. But again, bear with me. There's a rule that Hasidus brings. I brought the source over here. It's a whole Hasidic discourse, which is very interesting, but not to learn the whole thing right now. There's a Hasidic rule, classical. Mind rules over the heart by nature. That's the nature of the mind, and that's the nature of the heart. The mind is, God gave the mind the power to rule over the heart. There's a story to show this idea. The story happened with a chosid by the Alter Rebbe. This chosid was called Moshe Meidlich. He was a sage himself, a great, great. The Alter Rebbe said by Moshe Meidlich, he has Moichin Rechavin, he has a very wide head, brain, like really understand things, really. And this guy, Moshe, spoke perfect French. The Alter Rebbe lived, he passed away 1812. So you can imagine the time and the place of the earth in Russia, 1812. So this Moshe spoke perfect Russian, perfect Yiddish, of course, perfect Hebrew, perfect French. And the French generals of Napoleon who were trying to enter Russia, they couldn't do it because of winter. Okay, story is known. You don't need me for story class. They made all kinds of things to try to conquer actually Russia. And they took this Moshe as a interpreter to help them deal with things in Russia, etc., etc. So it comes out that, I think I mentioned this in a different class, doesn't really matter the detail, but comes out that Moshe was a spy, actually, for the Russian government against the French, because the Alter Rebbe was not very fond of Napoleon, but whatever. So he was a spy. He was a spy. Everything, they trusted this Moshe so much that they put the maps and the campaigns, you know, generals and soldiers and everything in front of him, and they didn't care about him, because anyway, this Jew, who cares? He looked basically like me, you know, with the beard and everything. He was a very religious Jew, a very, very great rabbi himself. They trusted him so much that they did everything in front of him, and then he went and informed the Russians where the French were trying to come from, etc., etc., and they always lost. They didn't know why. One time, it happened that they were discussing certain strategy, and Reb Moshe was over there, and suddenly Napoleon entered the tent of the generals. Napoleon himself, he entered the tent, he saw around, and he saw his generals, okay, and he saw this Jew. And he didn't like it. What do you mean, Jew over here? So he went running towards Moshe, and he put his hand on his heart, like this, strong, and said, "You are a spy!" That's what he said to Reb Moshe. "You are a spy," touching the heart, you know. And when somebody comes up and then discovers you, you know, your heart starts pumping, boom, 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 stronger. And Reb Moshe was very, very tranquil, very quiet. And he said, "I don't know why you're saying this." So Napoleon saw that Reb Moshe was not nervous at all. Like, "I don't know, I'm not a spy. If you're really not a spy, you don't get nervous. I don't know, you're crazy." So Napoleon said, "Okay, this guy is not a spy, forget it." He didn't get nervous. And they continued discussing the strategy. Later, when Reb Moshe was by the Alter Rebbe, he related the whole story. And he told the Alter Rebbe, "You know why I was able to control my heart? Because the mind rules over the heart by nature." He had such a powerful and deep mind that he was able to control his heartbeat, not to get nervous with this Napoleon guy on top of him. He didn't get nervous. So that's the way God created the world. Mind rules over heart. But there's a difference between Jews and non-Jews. What's the difference? This is quoted, I copied the text itself from a Maimer, from a Hasidic discourse of the Rebbe. And he puts this into a bracket, like he's discussing emotions and intellect, etc. And in the brackets, he brings this thing. This is the difference between Jews and non-Jews. Regarding non-Jews, this is the subject I wanted to learn. And in the next slide, we'll see much more details on this. In the intellect in non-Jews is for the emotions only. Again, this is the text of the Rebbe. I'm just quoting. That's why it does no explanation over here. Intellect is for emotions only. Similar to the cunning of the wolf, like he's a very smart animal, smartest of all animals. He's really a smart animal. He has some kind of intellect. But what's the purpose of the intellect? Emotions. Therefore, it's not possible to demand from them, this is what the Rebbe says, that the mind should govern over the heart. The rabbi just gave a whole class talking a Mises story by Reb Moshe, whatever, mind rules over heart. Forget it, it's not for Jews, for non-Jews. It's not for non-Jews, just for Jews. You cannot demand, says the Rebbe, from non-Jews that the mind should govern the heart, because the mind is only for the heart, says the Rebbe. And then he continues, regarding the Jew, it's the other way around. It is written, "Know the God of your father," Da'as Elokei Avicha, in Hebrew, by them, by Jews, the main thing is the intellect. That's why there can be knowledge and recognition of divinity, and also the issue of mind governing the heart. This is what the Rebbe says. Why am I bringing this? I'll explain this in a minute, and you will see it's not as bad as it looks. Patience. Why am I bringing this? Because it is very common that non-Jews take books that Jews wrote. Tanya is one of them, one of the most famous, talking about emotions, talking about conflict that a person has, his problems with God, etc., etc. Very nice. You can read the whole book, no problem. But who told you it's written for non-Jews? How do you know each one of the ideas that is brought over there is for non-Jews also? It's not so simple. It's not so straightforward. Certain ideas are for Jews and non-Jews, and certain ideas are not. If we just stop, so to speak, we're not going to do that, but if we stop on this particular text, you have to say that somehow we cannot demand, see the words of the Rebbe, we cannot demand from non-Jews to control the emotions, that the mind should control the emotions. Maybe you can find some non-Jews that accomplish that. It could be, but you cannot demand it. Why? Because the purpose of the intellect is for the emotions. What does that mean? Let's see a little bit better. This is part, very small part, of a different discourse by the fifth Rebbe of Chabad, with the same title, actually. If you see Zachor and Zachor, it's the same title. I know that, but different years. This would be 19... just a second. This is Ayin... 1919. Okay, he writes over there, it's a long discourse, but in some parts he writes the difference between when the intellect is for the purpose of emotions or when the intellect is for the purpose of intellect itself. And it's very interesting. And the truth is, even though in that discourse he doesn't discuss that, but the truth is, it has direct relationship with how the Hasidic thought sees a regular non-Jew, and I stress the word regular, I'm not talking about B'nai Noach, I'm talking about regular non-Jew and a regular Jew. It's very interesting. One is related to one name of God, Elohim, whatever, for those who know, very, very nice, for those who don't know, don't worry, and the other one is related to Avaye. So it's a different way of thinking, the different way of understanding the role of each human being in earth. And this is what comes out, practical things. What does that mean, intellect for emotions? The intellect is directly related to the material world. What's below yourself? I mean, in earth, how to get what you want. I want richness, I want greatness, I want honor, I want money, I want food, I want drink, whatever you want, it doesn't matter. Intellect is thinking, how do I get that? I want more of whatever, or less of whatever. Each person is different. It's an intellect, a different idea, that looks for justification of anything that a person does. Even when you know, and knowledge is intellect, even when you know that your behavior is not so good, for whatever reason, place, time, I don't know. You always try to find the logic why, in this particular case, it's okay. It's not a problem. Because I was forced, because I didn't know better, because whatever the reason, I don't know. That's the type of intellect that is completely subservient, so to speak, to emotions. And by nature, emotions are something you feel strongly within yourself. That's why it says, actually, Adam Etz Asadehu, in Parshas Kisavoy, it brings that the man is a tree, it's compared to the tree of the field. Why? The main thing of a tree, of vegetables, is to grow. This idea of growing represents emotions, not intellect, emotions. Because intellect represents something that moves from one place to another. One day you think one way, another day you think a different way. So it moves from one place to another, represents an animal. But the vegetable doesn't move, it just grows, represents emotions. Why? Because, again, emotions are the main thing of a person, that he feels so strong about his emotions. But emotions come together very tight to a feeling of yourself, me. I feel like this. So it's important for me. It doesn't really matter if it damages something, somebody else or something else. I feel this way. I need this. It's a lot of I, ego. And even if you're talking about abstract intellect, like math, engineering, so whatever, which has nothing to do with emotions, because a person is a mathematician, it's not about emotions, it's about numbers or whatever. Still related, this abstract thinking, to the material source of things. How is this formula of mathematics? How can I actually build this building, etc., etc., even if it's not related to emotions? And it's related to understanding the nature of things, how this thing actually works, which actually the whole science is built around. Try to understand and give me modelos, I don't know. Give me the ways to understand whatever you're actually experiencing and watching and thinking, etc., etc. So we see that intellect for emotions either works toward growing the emotion, reaching whatever you want, whatever your emotion towards is. Some people want to be rich, some people want to eat more, some people want to be greater, whatever the case is. And even in an abstract way, it's just directly related to material, how this thing works. And even in math, how these two numbers get together and actually work together, that's intellect for emotions, for the purpose of emotions. Then you have intellect for itself. Intellect for itself is directly related to God. He's not trying to find out what's below you. Rather, the other way around. What's above me? Where do I come from? It's trying to understand how things are really nothing compared to God. Like we say that the creation is yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. So intellect by itself is trying to understand what's the nothing. I understand what the yesh, what something is. I see, I open my eyes and I see the world around. I understand the world. Very nice. Where does it come from? That's a question that intellect asks, not with the purpose of reaching something. I want more food. I want more money. No. You're not going to get anything. You're actually going to get nothing. The nothingness of God. What's above me? I don't know. He wants to understand. He's occupied in understanding the divine source of everything. Where does this come from? Why was it created this way? And even when it's related to emotions, in the emotions itself, tries to impregnate them, like applying them a feeling of divinity. Love, again, as we've explained before, love is, it's okay, it's a good emotion. Fear is not a good emotion. You should fear if somebody walks with a knife like crazy in the street, you should be afraid and run away. Of course, this guy is crazy. I don't know what he's doing. I don't like it. I run away. So it's good. Fear is a good feeling and love is a good feeling, etc. But it has to be, again, guided towards God. So this type of intellect for itself looks for what does God want from this emotion? How can I apply this emotion and use it in my service to God? Not in my service to myself, to God. And even when it's an intellect that is related to emotions and is not an abstract thing, wants to focus, again, this is the same thing, it's the same idea, wants to focus towards God. In the case, in this column, so to speak, intellect for emotions, when you have an abstract intellect, which is not related to emotions, wants to understand the material of the thing. What's the nature of this? How does it work? And on the other way, the exact opposite. When you're talking about intellect related to emotions, which is not an abstract thing, still wants to guide the emotions towards God. So we see in these two different columns what the explanation of I'm going back on purpose, what the Rebbe was saying over here. Usually, Jews, because they have a divine soul, whatever that means, have this quality, I'm going back and forth, of intellect for itself that has the quality of looking up. What's above me? Where do I come from? What does God want from me? How do I use this towards God? Going back again. Whereas non-Jews, they're more related to the world. And their role is to actually improve the world with ethics and with morals and righteousness, etc., but to everything within the world. That's why, because they're so related to the world, which means looking down, so to speak, looking below, intellect for emotions, Again, the Rebbe said, you cannot demand from them that the intellect should actually rule over the emotion, because the intellect is directly influenced by the emotion. But because a person has an emotion that he wants richness, he wants greatness, he wants honor, etc. And now the intellect serves that emotion. How can I get more of this? So you have to think, okay, that's intellect, but it serves the emotion. This is what the Rebbe was saying over here in this particular part. Don't ask from regular, stress the word, non-Jew, that his mind should rule over the heart. Of course, not by nature. But, and we learned this in a previous class, Bnei Noach have a plus, so to speak, something more. What is it, something more? By being connected to Jews, that gives them the advantage of basically both worlds, and being able to project the world of, so to speak, material emotions into a higher level of understanding. In order for the spirit, this is a copy actually of a little piece of a class by the Rebbe, of a sikha by the Rebbe, that we learned actually this before, when we learned the beloved this man, that he was created in the image of God, etc. This is a very small piece of that teaching by the Rebbe. In order for the spiritual work of Bnei Noach, in the observance of their commandments, as it should be, they cannot base themselves on their own intellect, because their intellect can lead to coarseness. Why? We just learned that. Now we're supposed to understand it a little bit better. Why would intellect lead to coarseness, to something ordinary, to terrible things like the Nazis, Yimach Shemon, their name should be erased? Why? They were not stupid people. They were very smart, very advanced. Why did their intellect lead to the most terrible deeds in the world? Why? Because it's intellect geared toward emotions. It's intellect to the service of emotions. And usually, regular material emotions are coarse. I want more money. I don't care about anything. I want more, whatever, drinks. I don't care, etc., etc. So when the intellect is to the service of that, necessarily, intellect becomes more coarse. It thinks only about the things that it wants to get. When their intellect, and this is also the explanation, we learned this before also, why does the Rambam say in his Laws of Kings, when talking about Bnei Noach, that a person that fulfills, a non-Jew that fulfills the seven commandments because their intellect dictates so, not because Moshe Rabbeinu and the Torah and God gave, forget about God. I think it's a moral and normal behavior not to steal, not to kill, etc., etc. The Rambam says, "Veloy michachameihem." He's not a smart person. Forget it. He's not a wise guy. But wait a second. He's behaving properly. He's doing what he has to supposed to be doing. Not stealing, not killing, etc. Why do you call him not a wise person? Because sooner or later, the coarseness of the emotions is going to generate the coarseness in the brain, in the mind. And it's going to lead to not wise behaviors, so to speak. On the other hand, when their intellect, so intellectual soul, whatever, of Bnei Noach is guided, there's a mistake over here, by a Jew whose image of God is complete, because God created him this way, not because we're meritorious or anything, also the soul of Bnei Noach reached the level of the soul of man rises above. These are the words of the Rebbe. What is the Rebbe saying over here? Wait a second. When this non-Jew stops being a regular, I stress the word, non-Jew, and connects to Torah, to God, to mitzvahs, to teachings, this is the general explanation of connecting to a Jew, whatever, a rabbi or whatever you want to call it, doesn't matter. Then, wait a second. Something happens over here. It's not that the nature of the person changes. No, I'm sorry. Nature doesn't change. But he has the power that his mind can control the heart. Why? What's the connection? Because the whole reason why, look at this verse over here. The soul of man is from Koheles, from Ecclesiastes. Soul of man rises above. The soul of animals go down. That's what the verse says. So if a person connects to a different realm of reality. What does it mean? When a person starts understanding that there's something above, forget about below. I don't care about below. I care about above. And once you care about above, you start really looking and searching, and you will find. What will you find? Torah, Yiddishkeit, Judaism, authenticity. Then, your soul starts rising above. That same soul, again, the verse continues, that the animal looks below, that same soul now says, wait a second, I understand that that's my nature. Not that you're an animal. Chas v'chalila. God forbid. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, you're a human being, tzelem elokim, you have an image of God, but the nature does not help you to look above. So there's a jump, so to speak. There's something not that you can change the nature, but you can change your role in the world. You can start looking above by being connected to Torah, to mitzvahs, because God said in the Mount Sinai and gave it through Moshe Rabbeinu, etc., etc. And then you can start being a light onto every single person around you, Jews and non-Jews, because you should know. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but whatever, I'll say it anyway. You should know that many Jews are inspired by non-Jews. I say this to many people that I meet, whatever, Jews, I'm talking about Jews. If they knew the thirst for Torah that non-Jews have, they would definitely at least start looking into it. What does it say? Is there anything for me over there? But whatever. What I'm trying to say is, again, you will not change your nature because that's the way God created you. However, you can accomplish that your mind should rule over your heart. Conclusions. I'm just repeating very briefly what we saw. Structure. There's a structure that God created the whole world with the same structure. God himself, he expresses the structure, the creation, the man, tabernacle, everything is in the same structure. And basically, we could divide this structure into two parts, intellect and emotions, mind and heart. And we can understand that this is what the Rambam says, meditating, thinking, contemplating, etc., produces and fuels emotions. You can start appreciating something when you think about it, etc., or the other way around. Mind governs the heart. In a Jew, it's by nature. In a non-Jew, okay, you're right, it's not by nature. But by being connected to Torah and learning guided by a Jew, you can also accomplish basically the same thing, that your mind should rule over your heart in order to guide your emotions in the proper direction.